Writing the Southwest is an attempt to find a broad audience for the diverse voices from across the cultural and racial spectrum of the American Southwest. It is dedicated to the unconventional reader in and outside the region who will help these writers tear down the literary barbed wire and open up the range of human possibility exposed under the flaring sun of the American Southwest.
Literary scholar David Dunaway. He'll be back in just a moment with more about Writing the Southwest, his new book and companion award-winning radio series. Welcome to Soundings, a weekly magazine about books and ideas from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. Partial support for Soundings comes from Carolina Power and Light. We keep the lights on and more. The American Southwest is vast and beautiful, filled with dramatic landscapes and breathtaking vistas. It's also home to a growing number of writers whose work is as diverse and powerful as the scenery they inhabit and describe. Under the editorship of literary scholar David Dunaway, several of these poets, playwrights, essayists, and novelists come together in a new book and companion radio series, both entitled Writing the Southwest. David Dunaway is a professor of English at the University of New Mexico. He says that a sense of the land, devotion to home, and connections between different races and ethnicities make up the genuinely multicultural basis for Southwestern literature. Much of this writing is based in oral traditions, but recently the literature of the American Southwest has moved beyond regionalism and into the literary mainstream. I asked David Dunaway to begin our conversation by talking about one of the principal inspirations for Writing the Southwest, the land itself.
A sense of place is probably one of the things that joins all the authors together. One way I understand it is like the folklore of a people. The literature of a community is carved from the landscape. It has the depressions and the mountains and the valleys. And as we travel through with our eyes through the books of these authors, they take us inevitably on a trip into their world. And as to why writers in the Southwest are so devoted to place, there are a number of possibilities. One is the fact that, we have so little in comparison with the rest of the nation, so little man-constructed environment, so little built environment. The sky is so omnipresent, the landforms, the dramatic buttes and rocks mm-hmm. that rise from the surface of the earth are so important. Another is the connection between the sense of place and the spiritual. And I can think of no better example than to quote the Navajo poet Lucy Tapajanso, who pointed out to me once in a conversation that for her, her gods, the gods of the Navajo people, the first people who came into the Navajo reservation in the corner of Arizona and New Mexico, came out of the earth, according to their cosmology. And what this means is that for us, when we try and get in touch with the spiritual, for most of us, whether pagan or Christian, we look up into the sky to get a sense for an omnipresent being. But for her, she looks down at the earth.
You make me think of writers like Wallace Stegner and Tony Hillerman, both of whom have talked about this, what you called the presence of the sky, that unbelievable sense of clarity and distance and the light. Is it Hillerman who says that the air in New Mexico is not transparent, it's translucent? I thought that was a wonderful description. David, tell me about some of the writers that you include in Writing the Southwest.
Well, you mentioned Tony Hillerman, best known for his Navajo and Hopi detectives set and his mystery stories set on the Navajo reservation. Barbara Kingsolver is another popular author from Arizona. Originally a Southerner, she came to New Mexico and Arizona in an effort to try and find a new life. Of course, writers have been finding new lives in the Southwest ever since the days of Zane Grey. And in some ways, I think that what Barbara Kingsolver doing is an updated version of Zane Grey. Still, there is the woman who gets off the freeway or the train.
Mm-hmm.
But it isn't Miss Kitty anymore from Gunsmoke. It isn't the Southern debutante.
Right.
Today, we have a strong and independent woman who is looking for a place without the restrictions of her past.
Well, it's wonderful. The landscape invites people not only to become part of the landscape, it invites them to reinvent themselves after a fashion. That's what's happening in some of these writers.
Reinventing is certainly one of the themes of this series and the accompanying book, Riding the Southwest. Terry McMillan is another author, fairly well known. She has that popular Waiting to Exhale, a book and film. And she was living in Arizona around the time that we recorded her session. Edward Abbey, the prominent environmental author, always controversial, is another well-known figure. But there are a lot of Native and Hispanic authors who aren't so well-known. Joy Harjo comes to mind. She is a Creek poet, part Irish, part Creek, grew up in Oklahoma in a working-class community near Tulsa. And her first artistic inspiration was the Miles Davis Quartet of the 1950s.
Jazz.
John Coltrane performing.
She plays the trombone, do I have that right?
It's the saxophone.
The saxophone, right.
And she's a very strong saxophone player. She puts her all into it, and ultimately she plays with a group called Poetic Justice. She is in the tradition of the beat poets of San Francisco, whose work kind of transcends time and has a beautiful counterpoint between music and lyric.
David, let me stop you for a moment. We're talking about your book and radio series, Writing the Southwest. The landscape you have been talking about as a fundamental ingredient in these writers' imaginations and lives. What about, to put it crudely, the idea of message or theme or concern? How would you characterize these writers individually or as a group when it comes to the kinds of topics that they're writing about? What, in effect, makes this Southwestern writing unusual or unique from the standpoint of questions like that?
Well, we've said that Southwestern writers share a landform, but in addition, they resist a commodification of that very landform. So much, let me put it this way.
It ain't Hollywood.
In a landscape so dependent upon water,
right,
so dependent on coexistence with the natural elements, the tendency is to look for inspiration below us, above us, beauty all around us, as the Navajo sing has it. And, of course, as the modern world has come to the American Southwest, which many of us think of as a small third world country on the edge of the United States,
right,
as the population has grown, we have these Phoenix-like suburbs that are simply delivered, prepackaged, and pre-made into areas where they don't quite seem to make sense. And that's a commodification of the land. And I think many of the authors that I'm working with, from Edward Abbey to Frank Waters, A to W there, Frank Waters often nominated for the Nobel Prize as America's best-known unknown author. These authors are chary of the development path, and they're looking for alternatives. Edward Abbey always used to say, don't come out to the Southwest. It's full of rattlesnakes and things that prick and bite and sting, and you won't last long out here, and you'll dry up from the lack of water. And, you know, sometimes my students, they read Edward Abbey, and they say, oh, well, I don't want to go out to the Southwest. And I think he'd be happy at that point.
Talk to us for a few minutes, David Dunaway, about the work of the artist, the aesthetics that are involved here. How, for example, does the writing of the Southwest differ from, say, a novelist up in Seattle, Washington, or a short story from a short story writer from Mississippi? Do we have some universals at work here, or again, distinctive elements?
Well, I think there are both universal and distinctive elements, and with 13 authors, there's going to be some variety. A person like Alberto Rios grows up on the Mexican-American border, just 3 miles from Mexico. And of course, he is concerned about the relationship of the ends and the middle, about the crossings across a culture. I'm not sure that there's a stylistic distinction, but a thematic unity for all of these authors is going to be their sense of the outsider and the insider, a sense of the crossings across races and across ethnicities, so that many of the authors here are struggling with the passage not just from one country to another, but the borders that separate individual communities. Mm-hmm. And I think this next excerpt from the author Joy Harjo gives us a very nice example of what it feels like to be caught between these two cultures, to be Indian, but to live in a world where you still have the MTV.
You're hit with it from the time you're born. What I saw growing up was blonde hair and blue eyes valued above Indianness, and the darker you were, the more difficult it was for you. My darker relatives went through hell. I went through some, but not as much. I mean, I can pass, you know, even though I look like an Oklahoma half-breed. And the problem with being between cultures and peoples is that there's such polarization. You become the face of the enemy, yet you're also part of the family. People, I think, born there usually, you know, go with one side or the other. You know, wind up destroying themselves in some way. It's like a gift of fire, a gift that you can burn your house down or you can use the fire to cook your dinner. And after a lot of near tragedy, I came to a point where there's not that many people born with this kind of point of view. And I've decided to let it be my strength rather than to let it destroy me, because it's never comfortable.
At an early age, Joy Harjo had a mystical moment, one of those which suddenly illuminates one's interior life. After this experience, music, particularly jazz, became as essential to her as writing.
It was one of those hot summer days. It was so hot that the tar would stick to your shoes. So I was riding in the back seat of my dad's car, and it was probably one of his Cadillacs, which he polished and took care of. He took care of these cars much better than he did his children. I was standing in the back seat, and I was smelling his Old Spice hair shave and looking at the back of his head, and the radio was on. And the radio was always a very seductive force for me because of the music. And I listened, and I remember following this jazz trumpet solo. I followed that Miles Davis solo, and I suppose it was an ecstatic moment, but it was also a moment of great devastation in an odd way, because I suddenly realized my parents' failings as human beings, and even my own. It was as if I saw my whole life stretch the length of that horn line.
David Dunaway, we just heard an excerpt here from your radio series, Writing the Southwest. This was the voice of Joy Harjo, who was a Native American, a poet, and a musician. Let me ask you to comment on a kind of a paradox that comes out of this kind of writing. On the one hand, these writers want to retain their distinctiveness. They want to stand there and say, I am who I am, in terms of ethnicity or race or attachment to the land. On the other hand, they're having to fight the battle, or at least consider the issue, of getting into this mass American culture of the 1990s. Where do they land, again, collectively or individually, when they struggle with an issue like that?
Well, some authors, particularly the very best-known authors like Tony Hillerman, have no problem making that conversion. You might say that the medium of publishing, mass publishing, is set up to deliver a product which millions of people will appreciate, and you can hardly walk into an airport bookstore without finding the works of Tony Hillerman there. It uses a popular genre, and thus in some ways avoids the issues of cultural representation and authenticity, because, hey, it's a literary genre, and you can expect a genre response. But on a different level, you've got the many people who represent cultures widely separated from the mainstream of American culture. Simon Ortiz, for example, is an a poet of the Acoma Reservation, which sits 600 feet above the surface of the earth on a butte in the middle of, well, they would say everywhere, and most people would say nowhere, somewhere near the Arizona-New Mexico border. And for him, he was one of the first Native American poets to be published nationally by Harper, and had a considerable following. But so much of modern publishing is built around fads and moments in time, and there are very few ways that someone who comes from outside the publishing mainstream, who doesn't go to New York City three times a year to meet with an agent and a publisher, can find a vehicle for their work. Some authors in the group might be considered local authors, in the sense that they're so tied to their sense of place and the identity within their community that they no longer have a universal. Others, like John Nichols, find a universal in a grain of sand.
This is the man who wrote the Milagro
Beanfield War, right?
They made that into a Redford film, did they not?
They did, and he's somebody who was raised in New England, who had a terrific success in his 20s, just out of college with The Sterile Cuckoo, who found himself a smash author and then became involved in the anti-war movement of the 1960s.
David, I want to be contentious with you. I can't let you get away without at least trying to argue with you in terms of some of the criticism that might come up, or the commentary, cultural commentary about writers and writing in the Southwest. Namely, that what we're up to here is really a form of cultural therapy, that we're trying to convince the rest of America that, oh, well, we ought to take seriously these Native American and Chicano writers, but, oh, they're really not writers. We're just sort of accepting them into the fold, and they don't do the work of the writer. They don't really earn the merit of, you know, these New England writers or New York writers. What about this?
Well, for centuries, America's writing was the writing of New England, and the area, only the South really was allowed to have a regional literature. I think that now the Southwest is fashionable in its earth tones and pastels for designers, in its blue corn
right.
tortilla chips. And we have one of the periodic vogues in Southwestern culture and Southwestern literature. It will pass. Another region will come to the fore. But I think you raise a very important question about what the contributions of the Southwest are culturally to the nation. And I guess I would say that many of the issues of cultural pluralism, of learning to live with your neighbor, are being worked out in the Southwest in a positive way that has something for the rest of the country. And we see this in the literature, where we have these crossings between Hispanic and Native American, between Anglo and Hispanic. I think it's important to recognize that we have a degree of racial harmony and respect in the Southwest, which has been hard won, and it's maybe a road paved with the blood of many of the groups that have suffered, whether it's the Hispanics, who were never allowed to speak Spanish in their schools and had were expelled for speaking their own language, whether it's the Native Americans on the Trail of Tears, who were marched across the country to the Southwest from the Southeast. These are memories that live with us in our own time, and yet I sense a recognition and a willingness for people to respect and give a little bit of elbow room to these cultures. And if Southwestern literature has anything to give to the nation, it's a sense that we are a joined people from different backgrounds.
David Dunaway, give us another sample here from your radio series, Writing the Southwest, and in fact, the material that appears in the accompanying book.
We've talked about cultural diversity, and one of the key issues is exactly how can you honestly write across cultures. Here's an example from Barbara Kingsolver talking about what it means to write about Native American when you're not a Native American.
The snowy plaza was marked with a single line of tracks. In the center of the white square stood a tall young woman in a black dress that hung from one shoulder. Her other shoulder was bare.
Her waist, her upper arms and wrists, and her buckskin moccasins were all decorated with garlands of colored yarn, fur, and sleigh bells. At the crest of her head was a tuft of white eagle down. The sun shone purposefully on her hair. It was cut like Inez's, but hung loose to her waist, swaying as she moved slightly from one leg to the other, her feet barely leaving the ground. She looked graceful and cold. The sound of drums, and then the drummers themselves, emerged from the kiva. The four old men took their position at the edge of the plaza and propped their huge drums on their knees without missing a beat. They began a soft chant. A second line of men with blankets draped over their shoulders climbed down from the kiva, also singing, and took their places behind the old drummers. Then deer arrived, from everywhere. They were men and boys with black shirts and leggings, white kilts, and deer antlers. Their human features disappeared behind a horizontal band of black paint across the eyes. They moved like deer. They held long sticks in front of them, imitating the deer's cautious, long-legged grace, and they moved their heads anxiously to the side, listening, sniffing the wind. The woman in black stepped forward, shaking her gourd rattle, and they followed her. They became deer. They looked exactly as deer would look if you surprised them in a secret rite in the forest, moving in unison, following the irresistible hiss of a maiden's gourd rattle. To write that Pueblo scene, I did several things. One is I read everything there was in the library about ethnography and history and cultural background on the Pueblo people. I went to that Pueblo and I saw those dances. I talked with people to whom those dances are very important. You can write about something from the outside or the inside. I write about Native American characters from the outside, but I've never written one from the inside. I know what those deer dancers looked like because I saw them. I know exactly what they looked like, and I feel I have a right to describe that. I have no idea what was going on inside their heads. I have no idea what that young woman was thinking as she stood in that black dress in the snow, barefoot.
That was Barbara Kingsolver talking about how she wrote Animal Dreams, one of her fine novels set in the American Southwest. We're looking now in the Southwest today at a mixture, a cultural mix of that some call a mestizaje, a mezcla of cultures. We arrive at the point where Mexican culture meets American culture, where Hispanic culture from the originally from the conquistadores join hands with the newly arrived cultures of African Americans. Paula Gunn Allen, a Native American scholar from UCLA, writes in the preface to the book Writing the Southwest that for her there are three cultures in the Southwest, but they're not those traditionally defined as Anglo, Hispanic, and Native American. She calls them the Mexican, the Puebloan, that is the Pueblo tribes from the Southwest, the little tiny tribes along the Rio Grande, and finally the Anglo. And in Anglo, she includes African Americans, Asian Americans, everyone whose community are not indigenous to the Southwest. And I think this is typical of the kind of shifting of grounds that we have between cultures. And it makes the Southwest's writing some of the most exciting in America today.
David Dunaway, your book is Writing the Southwest. We should also remind our listeners that it is a radio series, the one true medium. Shall we add that?
Well, I think many of your listeners, like us, Wayne, love radio and have spent a lot of their years listening to it and gaining from it. One of the things that interested me in the preparation of this series was how an oral tradition, O-R-A-L, got in some ways sidetracked in America today. We watch things. We don't listen to them. Even though the soundtrack of television or radio, of television or film, is so central to what we get from those two medium, we never consider the fact that we're hearing television and hearing film. It might be nice to add here one little bit about the function of the poet in a world which is dominated by the screen. And here's Simon Ortiz from the Acoma Pueblo, his tribe's official translator, reminding us why we listen to poetry.
My scope is universal, but if I have anything to offer to literature, it's as a Native American writer who specifically is Ankoma. My audience is that great mass of people who I think needs to be reaffirmed of their humanity. Kind of a tall order, but what's a poet for?
I think radio offers us a chance to bridge the spoken word and the heard word. Many of us, you and I, have been listening to radio for many years and get a special pleasure from it because it allows us to people history and the surroundings in a work from our own imagination. Radio is a way of thinking as well as a way of hearing.
David Dunaway teaches at the University of New Mexico. His book, Writing the Southwest, is available in paperback from Plume, published by the Penguin Group. David Dunaway's companion radio series, also entitled Writing the Southwest, was awarded the 1995 Silver Reel for Documentary from the National Federation of Community Broadcasters. You're listening to Soundings, a radio magazine about books and ideas from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. Partial funding for this program comes from Carolina Power and Light. We keep the lights on and more. I'll be back in just a moment with information about where to write for an audio cassette of this program.
Well, look at honey. Give me land, lots of land, need stars, skies above. Don't fence me in. Let me ride to the wide open country that I love. Don't fence me in. Let me be by myself in the evening breeze. Listen to the mama of the cottonwood trees. Send me off forever, but I ask you please. Don't fence me in. Just turn me loose. Let me straddle my old saddle.
You're listening to Soundings from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. Audio tapes are available for $10 postpaid. Please write to us at Soundings, the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. Our zip code is 27709. When you write, please ask for program number 821. That's program number 821. Our address again is Soundings, the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. Our zip code is 27709. The National Humanities Center is a nonprofit independent institute that seeks to encourage excellence in scholarship, to strengthen teaching in American education, and to increase public understanding of the humanities. Next week on Soundings, award-winning writers Ian Frazier and Philip Richards. Ian Frazier will be here to talk about his new book, Family, praised by the New York Times as that rarest of events, a family reunion worth inviting strangers to attend. Philip Richards will be here to discuss his recent piece in Harper's Magazine about race, family, and what he calls his journey out of a Cleveland childhood. Until next week's show, thanks for listening to Soundings. Our theme music is by Jeff Perry. Soundings is a cultural affairs service of the National Humanities Center.